Hello, and welcome to another episode of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real World Perspectives. I am Diana Isaacs, joined by my co-host, Natalie Bellini, and we've got another episode dedicated to the 2025 ADA Standards of Care. So we already talked about the updates in technology, and now we want to tackle all of the updates to therapeutics, which there are a lot. Starting with the treatment algorithm. So the good news is the algorithm still has kind of that layout that we expect where things are stratified based on if a person has cardiovascular disease, kidney disease, or heart failure. And then if they don't have those things, it's really focusing on the glucose, how much glucose lowering is needed, or that kind of combined glucose lowering along with weight loss. But there are some notable changes. So in the past year, we had the FLOW trial with semaglutide showing positive outcomes in people with type 2 diabetes and kidney disease. And so we were wondering, how will the guidelines change based on this? And sure enough, the guidelines have changed, where in the past they said, well, first line should be an SGLT2 inhibitor because we know that those for sure have evidence in kidney disease. But now you will see that it's actually you can use a GLP-1 receptor agonist that's shown benefit, like semaglutide, or an SGLT2 inhibitor that's shown benefit. So that was one big change. Natalie, I'll turn it to you to either give your feedback or share another one of the changes.
So I think we should stop and have a little bit of feedback about this because just like, you and I are very pro, let's give options for people, right? So there are people who cannot tolerate an SGLT2 inhibitor. They either end up with mycotic infections or they have a history of lots of UTIs and they're just, it just isn't appropriate. They try them and they come back and they say, I'm never using that again. It's not a huge percentage of the population, but it is a percentage. So now we have another option and guided and directed by our guidelines, right? I think you and I both love the combination of the two, right? Some SGLT2 inhibitor, some GLP-1. It feels like that it just makes this magic happen where we get glucose lowering, we get weight loss, we get people who say, I just feel better. But nobody, like, there's a lot of side effect concern, and I can't take this, I can't take that, I don't like it. I'm worried about it. And now we can say, okay, if you're concerned about this for whatever reason or you couldn't tolerate it, now we can try this instead. And so I'm excited about that because it just gives us more options to protect people from kidney disease, which once you have kidney disease, you have all these other problems, right? It ends up with heart disease. It ends up with, we see this tumble after that. So if I can look at someone with proteinuria and say, look, you've got proteinuria, let's try a little bit of an SGLT2. And in my practice, I only use the lower doses. I typically don't go up at all. I just use that first starting dose. The increase doesn't really get as much more glucose control. So I tend to use those lower doses and leave it at that. If they can't tolerate it, now I can say, gee, let's try a GLP-1 instead, right? But really, I still in my heart and soul believe the magic is in the combination.
I completely agree. We're going to use the combination for most people. The other thing I think is important is that when GFR is below 45, you're typically not going to get glucose lowering from the SGLT2 inhibitors versus you will with the GLP-1 agonist. So I think that's an important consideration too when deciding what therapy to use. If someone needs glucose lowering and it's not just for kidney protection, probably going to want to start with a GLP-1 agonist. But ideally, yeah, we're going to use that combination together. I would want to best protect the kidneys as much as
Right, because even though there's not as much glucose lowering from that SGLT2, there is kidney protection, right? So that's where that back and forth goes, right? But you're right. If I have an A1C of, 8.9%, and I give with a GFR of 42, I'm not going to get a whole lot of efficacy in glucose lowering from that SGLT2. So that's when I would say a little bit of an SGLT2 and a little bit of a GLP-1 will make that magic happen where I've protected the kidney and also got some glucose lowering out of it.
right. Next I want to talk about the heart failure stratification.
Yes.
So, because we were kind of wondering, like, will this change? Because we saw the positive data again with semaglutide in people with heart failure with preserved ejection fraction. So the algorithm itself hasn't changed. It still recommends an SGLT2 inhibitor as first line. But what has changed is there is a recommendation for people that have obesity-associated HFpEF to use a GLP-1 agonist that's shown benefit, like semaglutide. So I think that makes sense because the trial done with semaglutide was done in people with obesity. So that kind of makes sense. But I was wondering if the algorithm itself would change. That overall hasn't changed, but we do have this strong recommendation now to use a GLP-1 in HFpEF. Or a GLP-1/GIP, whatever agent has shown the benefit.
Absolutely. And we, you know, you and I are both doing that in our clinical practice now. I think when we think about what we do in clinical practice and the guidelines, I think we as clinicians who tend to be aggressive with our diabetes treatment, right, for the right reasons, we are like, come on, ADA, get your guidelines together. Come on, ADA. But the ADA creates their guidelines based on science. They don't create them on what Natalie and Diana think about what happens in Cleveland, Ohio to our patient populations, right? So sometimes it feels like we're waiting for the, but we have to wait for the trial, for example, Flow, right? That demonstrated that kidney protection. Then we can say now, okay, now you can use the semaglutide with, you know, with to reduce the risk of kidney disease, right? We needed that trial to demonstrate that. And it needs to be a strong trial. It can't be, wow, we picked 12 patients and we did this. It has to be randomized control. It has to be multi-centered. They're not going to make changes to the guidelines that we're supposed to be following across the United States. And even outside the U.S., these ADA guidelines are followed and used as a reference point without that. So because that trial was done in obesity specific, that's why that heart failure didn't change, those guidelines, you know. But we'll see more trials coming. And we know that these GLP-1s really do work magic on lots of different organs in the body.
Definitely. And I think the other big thing with this algorithm, because overall, the algorithm, it's kept kind of its core. So no one should be alarmed that it completely changed. But the big thing that has changed is now introducing liver disease really into that algorithm. And they've also renamed the terminology to be more in line how others have been classifying it. So the metabolic dysfunction associated steatotic liver disease, MASLD, as well as MASH, the metabolic dysfunction associated steatohepatitis. So it's classified as those versus our old terms like fatty liver disease or NASH. And what's unique now about the algorithm, I've actually got like my whole hard copy here in front of me. I love it. I like walk around with it everywhere. But now if additional cardiovascular or kidney risk reduction, management of other metabolic comorbidities or glycemic lowering is needed, then you ask, are there mitigating risk of MASLD or MASH? And if yes, you're going to use the agents with potential benefit, which actually calls out the GLP-1 or the dual GLP-GIP tirzepatide, or a combination with pioglitazone, because pioglitazone has shown benefit. And actually, I was talking with my student about this, and he pointed out, he's like, well, that's new pioglitazone. Well, last year they mentioned TZD with cardiovascular risk reduction. Now it calls out pioglitazone because really that is our only TZD we have to treat. But that's big. I mean, Natalie, what do you think about this?
Yeah, I think that we were all afraid of pioglitazone when everyone was using 45, because in America, we always make it more. More is always better. So give more of it. And then people had some side effects from it, right? But I do use pioglitazone in my practice. I use 15 milligrams, and it really does do a nice job at treating diabetes, at sensitizing that person, at reducing A1C. And I think we need to be less afraid of a medication at a lower dose. And I mean, I've prescribed it and then had primary care doctors say, this is terrible. This is awful. No, it's not. It's in our guidelines, and we should be using it. The lower doses are much safer, are efficacious. And fatty liver is, you know, this old fatty liver term. We would, if you had weight in your abdomen, but now we're realizing that MASH is a true issue, and it reduces life expectancy. The complications are severe, and we really need to be considering the way a person gains weight, what's going on, and really protect that liver from the from the disease itself.
Yeah. And there's now a whole diagram on risk stratification in about for MASLD, and basically using the FIB-4 score. And then if the FIB-4 score is over 1.3, then that kind of guides potentially referral to a liver specialist or kind of what to do next, imaging, versus if it's under that, then there's probably a lower risk of future cirrhosis. So that's something I know we've incorporated in our, like, it's easy to automatically calculate that in the EHR. And so that's something that now it's in our notes, we can automatically calculate that and determine where someone falls in that risk stratification.
So the next thing that's new is new guidelines on screening for type 1 diabetes. And we've talked about this a little bit in other podcasts that we've had. But remember now, in the past, we didn't understand you either had type 1 or you didn't have type 1. And it was yes or no. Now we know that people become antibody positive early in life, and that these people, we can look at the five different antibodies that we can draw. And if two or more of them are positive, that person has 100% lifetime risk of developing type 1 diabetes. So we know this. And there are now ICD-10 codes we can use. It's interesting because for the first time, I actually saw a patient that came in with a stage 1 type 1 diagnosis. And I was like, yes, we're doing it. It's coming. So stage 1 type 1 is normal glycemia. So a person could have anything they wanted whatsoever to eat and glucose wouldn't change. They have plenty of beta cell function left. Stage 2 type 1 is dysglycemia. So their glucoses rise after big meals. Their fastings are a little bit high, but they don't need insulin at this time. But what we call that is dysglycemia, right? That in-between phase. Stage 3 is what we know of type 1 now, where you need insulin to treat. So there are some nuances around that, but that's the general background. And there have been some guidelines like, hey, you should probably screen first-degree relatives, blah, 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 because the first-degree relative has approximately 15 times the risk of developing type 1 as someone who doesn't have a first-degree relative with type 1. Second-degree relatives have twice the risk as someone who doesn't have a relative with type 1. So the guidelines now say screen first-degree relatives. And I think this is going to help a whole lot in helping to find the people that have a potential of developing type 1 diabetes. And why do we care? Because they're going to need insulin one day. There's nothing to do to stop it. But there are two things. One is it delays we can slow down the progression by offering a drug called teplizumab. For those age 8 and older, and that is in the guidelines too, that we should consider that for appropriate patients. But also, if we know it's coming, we reduce the risk of DKA from anywhere from 40 to 60% at diagnosis down to 2 to 6%. Because if you can teach someone ahead of time what the signs and symptoms of type 1 diabetes are, then there's a reduction in that DKA at diagnosis, which improves outcomes for years to come.
Yeah, I think it's so great they've incorporated more of this into the guidelines. And I think about how far we've come now. The other thing that I think is very helpful is there's guidance now on what to do if someone is that stage 1 type 1 diabetes. I think this sometimes is a barrier to screening, is that, okay, someone's positive, now what? Like, how do you monitor? What do you do with them? And so now they provide guidance on what to do. And this is like the first recommendation in section 3 on prevention or delay of diabetes and associated complications. And it says that, or sorry, it's the second recommendation, but it says that in pre-symptomatic type 1 diabetes, that you want to monitor using an A1C approximately every 6 months, and then doing a 75 gram oral glucose tolerance test annually. And why is it? Why do the OGTT? Well, the OGTT, I know, we're sticking out our tongues. Nobody likes to do that test. I think the recommendation really comes from the fact that postprandial is often affected first before you start to see changes in fasting or A1C. So to really be most on top of it, and ideally you want to catch it as soon as it hits stage 2. So if you're going to offer teplizumab, like, you would want to know before that window closes and the person's already in stage 3, that they could do things to actually prevent that progression. And so that is the why. Now, in practice, I think that we may choose to use CGM, other methods, but in terms of guidelines, there's not really so much evidence to support using CGM. At least that is kind of a diagnostic right now. So I think this makes sense, and at least hopefully can offer guidance so people do feel more comfortable if they see these types of patients in their practice.
I 100% agree with you. We need guidelines to, you know, this is the challenge. In adult endocrinology, the people already have diabetes. They're already seen. They already have type 1. So I need their siblings. I need their moms and their dads and their siblings and their children to be screened. None of those people are typically my patient unless they somehow have thyroid condition or something else, right? So this has to happen in primary care and in pediatrics. And we were taught in school never to order a lab that you don't understand. And screening for diabetes are labs that you might not understand. So this gives us guidance to say, please, let's do this. In our practice, we are telling people if someone has one antibody positive, I want them in endocrinology just for the consult to see why are they antibody positive. Do they have thyroid disease? Do they have rheumatoid disease? Do they? And we might be able to help them find what's wrong, and it might not be diabetes at all, right? So there's that side of it. The other side of it is, what do we do in clinical practice? Well, with these new ICD-10 codes, we get to call people with stage 1 type 1 type 1, right? There's an ICD-10 for that. Stage 2 type 1 has its own code. So we have been able to prescribe continuous glucose sensors for these people and catch it even earlier. The problem is, again, here we are with ADA standards of care. There's no data on this, right? What we do in clinical practice is not what ADA can recommend at this time. We have to wait for trials to be done and data to be done around that. But we can give someone CGM. We can even give them a meter and say, wash your hands with real soap and water and check after your biggest meal once a week and call, like send me message through my chart to give me those numbers. And I then will decide when to put that continuous glucose sensor on your body. As soon as I see spiking, as soon as we, right? But again, none of this is in the guidelines yet, because this is all what we do in practice, not what the guidelines have to say. So, but I will conclude this little episode part of this with, this is so much better. Every year we're getting closer to get these people, find these people, they're out there. And it, to me personally, it's not just about screening and offering to teplizumab. It's also the breakthrough T1D is looking for patients with stage 1 and stage 2 type 1 diabetes, because they have other therapies they'd like to offer as well. And we need to help find them, to help find these delay onset, delay cure, delay, right? Like, we don't know yet, right? So what we want is, we want more people screened ahead of time for that reason alone. So, yeah, right? Screening for breakthrough T1D, formerly JDRF, for reducing that risk of DKA, and for offering to please them out for those people that qualify. All of those reasons are important.
For sure. Yeah. And then taking it back to kind of our other agents, our SGLT2 inhibitors and GLP-1 agonists. So there was actually in the nutrition section, the facilitating behavior change, there was a lot of added information about, for example, with SGLT2 inhibitors, it's recommended to avoid ketogenic diets. There's also a whole lot added about fasting, about religious fasting, and how to adjust medications based on fasting, which I think is amazing, that we've never had that before in the standards. And that's something that comes up pretty commonly in practice. And then they address some of these more controversial issues like GLP-1 agonists with perioperative care, and really didn't make a recommendation, rather referred to the fact that the anesthesiology organization has currently recommended to hold a weekly agent at least a week before surgery, a daily agent a day before, but that there's really not strong evidence to guide that. And it ultimately needs to be individualized and based on the team.
There's some screening about microvascular complications, right? The ADA clarified screening frequency and criteria, as well as management strategies. So on iHealth, in section 12.5, added if retinopathy is progressing or slight sight-threatening, an ophthalmologist should conduct more frequent eye exams. You would think that that's happening, and it is in clinical practice, but now it's part of the guidelines. I can tell you, we are in our practice now doing retinopathy screenings right in the office, and I cannot tell you how many people I have pulled as positive. And what we've done is we've actually, if they're positive, they get an immediate referral through Epic into our ophthalmology department, the retinal specialists, and they're seen within the next couple of weeks because it's so urgent to treat eye disease early. There's a lot of new treatments in eye disease, but they only work if we catch them early. So I'm really excited that they're saying we need to look at this differently. And again, in your favorite part of diabetes management, a dilated eye exam is now recommended before pregnancy and during the first trimester in people with type 1 or type 2 diabetes. And these people should be monitored every trimester, indicating greater flexibility in the monitoring frequency. So we need to be looking at these people with pregnancy and looking at and for eye disease. And I'm excited that that actually got put into the guidelines.
Yeah. And then the other thing I wanted to mention was vitamin D monitoring. So that, or vitamin D supplementation for prediabetes has been a hot topic.
Yes.
And especially the Endocrine Society recommends vitamin D, but there's a whole section in here about how the data is not consistent across trials. And so regular vitamin D supplementation for prediabetes is not recommended. Of course, if someone has a low vitamin D level, then it is. But they talk about that in some of the narrative, how they don't endorse kind of supplementation necessarily to prevent progression to type 2 diabetes. So it's one of our clinical controversies.
And it continues to be, right? So again, it's more about, again, here we are back with the ADA, right? They look at the studies and say, wait a minute, some of them say one thing, some of them say another. We can't make a clinical recommendation at this time. And I appreciate that. As frustrated as sometimes we get with it, it's actually the way science should be, right? This is what we should be doing at this time.
Right. So, and of course, it's some things are how you interpret the data, which is why there's multiple opinions and things on it. But yeah, overall, it's right. There's not strong enough to recommend it. And as much as people want there to be like this one vitamin or natural supplement that can prevent something, we unfortunately don't
have it. Right. Yep. Absolutely. Absolutely. You know what, Diana? One more thing real quick.
Yeah.
Is that there is an app. And ADA offers a free standards of care app that you can put on your phone as a clinician to reference at any time during your clinical practice. And I think this is really important. No one can remember all of this. I'm not going to remember all of this. I got the journal last week and brought it to the beach with me, right? Ridiculousness. And I'm reading it and my family's looking at me like I'm crazy. But I want to tell you, I put the app on my phone every single year. And I go through it when I've got a little bit of time to try to review all 300 pages.
That is fantastic. Yes. Thank you for reminding me. Definitely download the app. It is super helpful. And you can always do like Control F to find things. And awesome. Well, I think we covered a lot in this episode. I encourage you all to read all 300 plus pages. But if you don't, hopefully you find this helpful as a summary. And we will catch you next time on another episode of Diabetes Dialogue, Technology, Therapeutics, and Real World Perspectives.